Welcome to the Sharon Hour. Just starting with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Today I'm talking about whether living each day as if it were one's last is a good way to motivate us or not. Steve Jobs famously endorsed it in his commencement speech to Reed College, and I'm going to play you that in a minute. But others view living each day as if it were your last as problematic, and you're going to hear from them too. So first, here's Steve Jobs.
Truth be told, I never graduated from college. This is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference.
So goodbye, yellow brick road, where the dogs of society howl. You can't plant me in your penthouse. I'm going back to my plow, back to the house. owl in the woods, hunting the horny back toad. Oh, I finally decided my future lies beyond the yellow brick road. So what do you think you'll do then? They shoot down your plane. It'll take you a couple of vodka and tonics to get you on your feet again. Maybe you'll get a replacement. There's plenty like me to be found. Mongrels who ain't got a penny, sniffing for tidbits like you on the ground. Future lies beyond the yellow brick
. Tune to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Magoonis KX935. My topic tonight is live every day as if it were your last, according to Steve Jobs. But if that doesn't appeal, I have a different method later in the show. Right now we're hearing Steve Jobs' commencement speech that he gave at Reed College. He was in remission from cancer at the time. But he'd discovered a secret to life, or at least one he thought it was valuable to live by, and to relay to these graduating students embarking on their lives as adults about to enter the workplace.
I was lucky. I found what I loved to do early in life. Woz and I started Apple in my parents' garage when I was 20. We worked hard, and in 10 years, Apple had grown from just the two of us in a garage into a $2 billion company with over 4,000 employees. We just released our finest creation, the Macintosh, a year earlier, and I'd just turned 30. And then I got fired. How can you get fired from a company you started? Well, as Apple grew, we hired someone who I thought was very talented to run the company with me. And for the first year or so, things went well. But then our visions of the future began to diverge, and eventually we had a falling out. When we did, our board of directors sided with him. And so at 30, I was out. And very publicly out. What had been the focus of my entire adult life was gone, and it was devastating. I really didn't know what to do for a few months. I felt that I had let the previous generation of entrepreneurs down, that I had dropped the baton as it was being passed to me. I met with David Packard and Bob Noyce and tried to apologize for screwing up so badly. I was a very public failure, and I even thought about running away from the valley. But something slowly began to dawn on me. I still loved what I did. The turn of events at Apple had not changed that one bit. I'd been rejected, but I was still in love. And so I decided to start over.
I'm here to tell you, life isn't just what you think. It's full of puzzles, still just a puzzle to me. And every time you think you're ahead, it's not what it seems. Life tends to happen while you're still making your plans. So dare to dream big, cause it's worth taking a chance. And when tomorrow comes, you will know you gave everything. So just do what you love. So many things in life, and they're all here. Just do what you love, and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do anything. At times we find ourselves by the risk that we take. Turns out the best part, life is the love that we make. Seek the answers to all your questions. What can you see? We're all connected in life, we're all part of the same. The time we have here, short, but it's worth everything. No matter what, just know that there's nothing you cannot be. So just do what you love, and love what you do. There's so many things in life, and they're all here. Just do what you love, and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do it. And at times, it'll feel just like when it rains, it pours, you will see. And at times, it'll sing just like all the walls closed in on me. Just gotta. You love and love what you do. There's so many things in life, and they're all here. Just do what you love and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do anything.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight concerns how to live, basically. Steve Jobs, having gone through cancer and come out the other end, albeit temporarily, unfortunately, though of course all our lives are temporary, is the point, had found some answers about how to live.
I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again, less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. During the next 5 years, I started a company named Next, another company named Pixar, and fell in love with an amazing woman who would become my wife. Pixar went on to create the world's first computer animated feature film, Toy Story, and is now the most successful animation studio in the world. In a remarkable turn of events, Apple bought Next, and I returned to Apple, and the technology we developed at Next is at the heart of Apple's current renaissance. And Laureen and I have a wonderful family together. I'm pretty sure none of this would have happened if I hadn't been fired from Apple. It was awful-tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life's going to hit you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life. And the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking, don't settle.
Tune to the Sharon Hour and me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935, tackling tonight some ideas about how to live. And I'm quoting now from a commencement speech Steve Jobs gave to graduating students from Reed College, with some stuff he'd learned along the way related to that.
When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try and tell your kids everything you thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I live with that diagnosis all day, but turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and thankfully, I'm fine now. But this was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there.
Steve Jobs, whose 2005 commencement speech to Reed College I'm playing you now on this KX935's The Share in Our Tonight, did unfortunately have a recurrence of his cancer and died in 2011. But his legacy, which includes this speech, has had its effect on entire new generations.
Death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday, not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it's quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 60s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic, overflowing with neat tools and great notions. Stuart and his team put out several issues of the Whole Earth Catalog, and then, when it had run its course, they put out a final issue. It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age.
A reminder that Steve Jobs is addressing college graduates here.
On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off. Stay hungry, stay foolish. And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish.
The wise man has the power.
You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. You were just listening to Apple founder Steve Jobs, who in his commencement speech to a group of college graduates in 2005 suggested that we live each day as if it were our last. With his cancer diagnosis, he decided to do just that, and he changed things in his life for the last few years he had. Liana Dell, however, has a different suggestion and also cites someone with a terminal disease, but this person came to the opposite conclusion that Jobs did, as you'll hear.
So live each day like it's your last. Personally, I think this is a bad idea. I'm going to give you some reasons why I think it's a bad idea, and I'm going to argue for another alternative. I did some research, and it would appear as though this is just one of those expressions that's been around forever. I found where several people apparently have said it throughout history, even as far back as the Roman Empire, but I couldn't find its origin solidly linked to any one person in particular. Like most of you, I've been hearing it most of my life, and most recently while watching Steve Jobs give his now famous commencement speech. In that speech, he specifically said that by that time, he had made a 33-year habit out of looking in the mirror each morning and asking himself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And if the answer was no for too many days in a row, then he knew he had to change something. I completely get where he was going with this. Live life to the fullest. Don't settle for second best or waste time. Shake things up by using discomfort as a change motivator. I get it. All fine and good and great in theory, but here's what happened when I tried it. Having fully bought in to Steve's suggestion, I woke up the morning after watching the video, rubbed the sleep from my eyes, I leaned in for a closer look at my reflection in the mirror, and I said exactly the same words he did. Almost immediately, however, I got depressed. Now, I hadn't been depressed the night before. In fact, I'd been relatively content at bedtime, but my last day ever. Am I really going to go into work, even if I love it? No. Am I going to subject myself to rush hour traffic? I don't think so. Am I going to run menial errands or speak to people who get on my nerves? Highly unlikely. And I'm probably not going to floss. And what about that Well Women's appointment with my OBGYN? Not going to go there. Where I am going to go, if it's my last day, is Paris. And I'm going to max out all of my credit cards to take all the people that I love with me. I'm going to smoke French cigarettes, even though I quit years ago. I'm going to eat and drink whatever I want and flirt with a lot of Frenchmen.
Je me baladais sur l'avenue, le cœur ouvert à l'inconnu. J'avais envie de dire bonjour à n'importe qui. N'importe qui, et ce fut toi, je t'ai dit n'importe quoi. Il suffisait de te parler pour t'apprivoiser.
Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées.
Tu m'as dit, j'ai rendez-vous dans un sous-sol avec des fous qui vivent la guitare à la main du soir au matin. Alors je t'ai accompagné, on a chanté, on a dansé et l'on n'a même pas pensé à s'embrasser.
Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées.
Hier soir, deux inconnus, et ce matin sur l'avenue, deux amoureux tout étourdis par la longue nuit. Et de l'étoile à la Concorde, un orchestre à mille cordes, tous les oiseaux du point du jour chantent l'amour.
Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées. Aux Champs-Élysées.
You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. My topic tonight is about how to live, and Steve Jobs came to the conclusion that the best way was to live each day as if it were your last. Leanna Dell, however, discovered that attempting to do that was sincerely depressing, not a way to live at all.
I watched in the mirror that first morning as my smile turned into a frown. And the rest of the day was essentially shot, as was the day after that, and the day after that, because like any good experiment, you gotta try it more than once. Now, there are a few things about living each day like it's your last that don't make sense to me. First, there's the sense of panic that can ensue when faced with an imminent expiration date, whether real or hypothetical. Urgency causes stress. I know that if I say, I have got to, versus I really want to, my entire physiology changes. Also, in our last day scenarios, again, mine being Paris, they're entirely based on us being physically capable of pulling off all of the things on our list for a last day. Meaning, in order for us to actually die, there would have to be some kind of freak accident or natural disaster to take us out before midnight. Personally, I'd rather have one of those gorgeous Parisiennes take me out for dinner before midnight. But let's talk reality. I'm a writer, but I'm also a nurse. And I have been a nurse for 25 years. My career has spanned from oncology to heart transplantation and most areas in between. Last days aren't pretty. And I've seen a lot of people's last days. They can be peaceful at times. Sometimes they're not. But not one person that I've taken care of has been physically capable of accomplishing any huge thing on the day of their last breath. Not one. You're probably thinking, okay, she's being a bit literal right now and maybe a bit dramatic. And maybe I am. But I have a bit of a case study to share with you that supports the findings of my own mirror experiment. 9 years ago, one of my best friends in the world, Jeannesse Arendt, died of stage 4 breast cancer. By the time she'd become symptomatic enough to be diagnosed or to seek medical attention, it had metastasized to her lungs, liver, and bone. That diagnosis came in 2003, and she was given 6 months to live. That's just 180 days. Here was a vibrant, positive, energetic woman in her early 50s. A vegetarian, she worked out 5 days a week, she never smoked, and she rarely drank. That diagnosis was her mirror. And within days of hearing the news, she became intensely depressed. She disappeared into her home, and she only came out for appointments. She didn't want to speak to anyone, and she rarely returned phone calls. She also gave away most of her cherished possessions, including her much-loved cherry red Miata convertible. She had been writing a children's book, but she didn't want to finish it. She didn't want to check anything off a bucket list. She had absolutely no interest. Until day 181. To hear her tell the story, she woke up on that morning and said, wait a minute, I'm still here. She then marked day 181 as her new birthday, and she would refer to those horrible 6 months from that point forward as the year of her death. Her whole attitude changed. She started writing again. She got a tattoo because she'd always secretly wanted one. And she asked for her car back. Yes, she did. And she would drive around in that convertible with her little bald head tucked safely under a wide-brimmed hat. Her beautiful personality came back tenfold, and she lived for another 3 years from that new birthday on. Day 181 became Janessa's first day. Everything she touched from that point forward, she appreciated. And seeing the world through her eyes really was kind of like seeing it through the eyes of a child. She embraced every hour of every day with a renewed spirit right up until the eventual end. Yes, I do think that knowing we're going to die someday can be a motivator for some, including Steve Jobs, who was in remission at the time of his commencement speech. But how realistic an approach is that for the average person who's perfectly healthy? I think that most of us think about our last days on occasion, but we then put them in the back of our minds and go about our business. Still, some of us worry about that time constraint and rack our brains on how to leave our mark on the world, given our now myriad of choices, to the point of becoming completely incapacitated. Do you know that on my estimation, approximately 15% of the adults that I looked after while working on oncology said that getting cancer was one of the greatest gifts they'd ever been given? Yes, even for the percentage of those who were terminal, because of clarity. And Janessa said exactly the same thing. Once she got through the darkness, she was able to discover what was truly important to her, and she moved those items to the top of her list. And her 1 through 5 gave her joy regardless of outcome. Unpublished, she said to me once, "You know, I always wanted to be a writer, but guess what? I've been one all along." So what's the alternative to living each day as though it's your last? Live each day as though it's your first. If we lived each day full of wonder and appreciation while discovering a genuine sense of joy, I believe that motivation for our truest passion would be more likely to present itself. And Janessa started writing again after day 181 because there were more days on the horizon, not because there weren't. What a gift future days are. So I would argue that we can deal with day-to-day routine and responsibility while pursuing our passion. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. I now look in the mirror each morning and I ask myself, if today were the first day of my life, and I had more days ahead, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? Yes, I do want to go into work so that I can fund my joy projects and eat. Yes, I do want to get into traffic because it can take me where I want to go while giving me time to listen to some great books and admire the trees along the roadway. They're actually there and they're beautiful. Yes, I do want to feel the accomplishment of completed tasks and maybe even give a kind word and a smile to people who annoy me. And I definitely want to keep that OBGYN appointment because I want to know that I'm doing everything in my power to stave off that last day as long as possible. You see, Janessa knew that she had a lump in her left breast, but she chose to ignore it because she'd been diagnosed with fibroids so many times. She was convinced it was just more of the same. Please do not let this happen to you. If living each day as though it's your last works for you, that's great. But if it doesn't, I challenge you to get up tomorrow morning, look in the mirror, rub the sleep from your eyes, and try living each day as though it's your first and you've been gifted a future. Be that a day, a month, a year, or 40 years.
Sounds like maybe a better plan, right? You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking about how we should live our days. Tonight, we heard from Steve Jobs that we should live each day as if it were our last. Liana Dell, however, suggests that it's better to live each day as if it were our first. Remission from cancer prompted both those ideas, but that terrible scourge of our age notwithstanding, we're all in remission in a way. Life is a temporary condition. It's just that most of us simply choose to either not think about that or are trying to postpone our lives as long as possible. Most of us don't know when our life is going to be on its first day or its last. But this one woman, her name is Deborah Cousard, and her story is told by Katie Engelhart in the California Sunday magazine, knew exactly which day was going to be her last because she'd arranged it to be exactly that. She had dementia, and it wasn't getting any better. Still, she was very keen to get her affairs in order. And it was tax time, and she particularly wanted to get her taxes done. But her mind wouldn't always cooperate. Her husband had set up her cell phone with alarms, reminding her when to take her medications, when to eat, even when to use the bathroom, because she'd got to the stage where she was having accidents because she didn't always remember. Her body was failing her, and her mind was rotting. She said, "I used to be a Maserati, now I'm a clunker." So she decided to go for assisted suicide, which a few states and her state of Oregon did allow. The idea of spending the rest of her life in a nursing home where she might forget how to chew and swallow, she'd be subjected to all the other patients' crying and moaning, let alone the fact that she couldn't afford the almost $100,000 a year that a decent facility demands, gave her the horrors. She said something that maybe all of us have thought about. If she were a dog, she could be euthanized in a caring way, something I've certainly thought about. Most of us have had to euthanize our dogs at some point. And sad as it was also rather wonderful that we could be the source of alleviating their further pain and suffering. Obviously, with humans, it's a bit more complicated because you don't want somebody to do that to you opportunistically. But still, most of us don't want to die, but we also don't want to die in the most horrific way possible. And there's this organization, Final Exit Network, FEN, that Deborah found could help her do it in a foolproof, unpainful way. They weren't allowed to physically help because that's considered murder. So one has to do it on one's own, and one has to do it while one's still competent to do it on one's own. Brian Ruder is someone who helps run this network. He was raised Catholic, raised to fear God, raised to consider that taking one's own life was a mortal sin. But as he grew older, he decided he didn't believe in letting doctors decide when he should die. And he started volunteering for a group called Compassion and Choices, a national non-profit that lobbies state legislators to legalize assisted suicide, now more politically correctly called medical aid in dying. It pushes for death with dignity. The theory is that particularly baby boomers had seen their own parents die in an ugly, protracted hospital kind of way and wanted another way. In Oregon, which does qualify for assisted suicide, a patient has to be over 18, mentally competent, terminally ill, and have, in the estimation of two doctors, 6 months or fewer to live. The patient has to also self-administer this terminal medication. And as I understand it, the law also does exclude people with dementia, since by the time they're within 6 months of death, they may be too far gone to consent to much of anything. But Brian thought it wasn't fair that people had to die alone, and he found a network of volunteers, this Final Exit Network, FEN, who will teach people how to self-euthanize and then sit with them when they do it so they won't be alone. The way that they could do that while avoiding prosecution was to commit to instructing and advising and sitting with only, but never touching or hugging a client. What they did, and it's a bit gruesome, was provide a sturdy plastic bag and a canister of pure nitrogen for gas asphyxiation, which involved legally purchased equipment and was said to be painless. And their goal was to help not just the terminally ill or even dying, but anyone whose suffering had become intolerable or unbearable. Just a quick interruption of myself here to say you're listening to The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking tonight about ways to live. But if your life and the only way you knew to live it was taken away from you, then alternative ways to die. It's not that easy, as anyone who has lost it after dying has probably discovered it's not that easy. You can end up messing it up so badly that you're in a worse-off state as a vegetable, or making a terrible mess and having all the people around you having to clean it up after. So Deborah was very concerned about not leaving a mess, not going any of the other suicidal routes. But she was told that obviously she could live as long as she liked, but if she waited too long to choose her date of death, she might lose the ability and then her case would have to be dropped. Brian realized with Deborah that she'd made up her mind. He also volunteered at a suicide prevention hotline, so he knew about trying to keep people alive until a crisis had passed and they suddenly realized that they didn't want to die. He knew how to talk a person out of wanting to commit suicide. But he knew also with Deborah that she'd thought things through. He said she doesn't want to lose her selfhood, and she sees that happening. Realizing that nobody wants to die, he also realizes that for some people, it's the only way remaining for them. As for Deborah, she'd grown up in a spiritually unmoored home, writes Katie Engelhart in this article I'm quoting from for tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour. Deborah had been baptized as a Catholic, and then her father changed his mind and rebaptized her as a Protestant. And then he changed his mind altogether and decided the family wasn't going to church at all. He was a drunkard, and he yelled a lot. Plus, he sexually abused Deborah. For many years, she couldn't admit what he'd done. And during her girlhood, she simply imagined that it was a monster that made the nighttime visits. Ultimately, she moved in with her mother, got a job at a film company near Anaheim, first as a typist and then as a manager, rising as high as a person could without a college degree, which was actually pretty high for a woman, she thought. She didn't think herself clever, but she was good at her job and proud of the fact that she was the point of contact for hundreds of people. Weekends, she would go to TGI Friday with her girlfriends, and at one point she met her husband, David, who she said wasn't like the creeps at work who sometimes grabbed at her, or the old boyfriend who urged her to turn down a promotion because he thought the job of secretary suited her just fine. David was supportive. He'd want to hear her stories about her work at the phone company and even repeat them at parties, bragging about her to Deborah's astonishment. He was now in construction, but he'd been an antiques trader before, and the house was full of his old collections. The two of them imagined they'd known each other in the Victorian era, but that their relationship had been cut short for reasons they didn't know, and that God had sent them back to Earth to meet again. In 2008, Deborah was in a catastrophic car accident where she claims she died. She said the only thing she can remember is steering the van over the crest of a mountain, and then everything went dark. Her car hit a tree at 60 miles an hour, throwing her body into the dashboard and entangling the bones of her foot around the pedals. Deborah said that when she, quote, died, she crossed over into a place of brilliant light where she was free from pain and where her mother was waiting for her. The women stood together, but when Deborah tried to walk further into the light, her mother barred the way. She needed to go back for David. Deborah says, the next minute I'm awake, I'm in a helicopter, and someone's pressing on me. Paramedics had performed CPR and resuscitated her. Most of the major bones in her body were broken, and doctors told her she'd have to use a wheelchair. As she got better, Deborah found that her godless idea of death had been made enchanted. She thought constantly about the bright, beautiful place in the sky and knew that she wasn't afraid to return. After the crash, Deborah and her husband David spent most of their time taking care of each other. David helped Deborah with the pain pills and swore that the wheelchair didn't bother him one bit. He became Deborah's arms and legs. Deborah, for her part, tended to David through the blood clots and heart surgery and the cancer that ended up killing him. It was only after she, quote, died that Deborah began to see herself as she was. All the confusions and forgetting which she'd brushed aside were now very apparent. It was after her husband died that Deborah finally read the terms of the reverse mortgage he'd signed to cover their medical bills. She was worried she'd lose her home, stunned by how little money she had left. Even that was hard enough to think about because it was getting harder and harder to think in straight lines. Sometimes, sitting at a computer, she'd find she'd typed a page of complete gibberish. She took a memory test online and scored poorly, which told her that she was worse than she'd even thought. She told Brian she didn't recognize herself anymore. She said she'd loved her brain. So by the time she saw the neuropsychologist, something she'd been putting off for years. She was almost relieved to hear him say that what she had was dementia. Except when she read the doctor's notes afterwards, which said she should be exploring possible alternative care environments, and that until then she'd require in-home assistance on a regular basis. She promised the doctor she would start looking at nursing homes because she was worried that he might call some kind of housing authority and get her committed to an institution if she didn't. But she knew she couldn't afford a good nursing home, apart from hating the whole idea of it. Katie Engelhardt, who has written this story about her, first reported in the California magazine and brought to you now on this KX95's The Sharer Now, said that she asked Deborah what she thought it would be like to be completely demented. And Deborah didn't seem to know. She said she wasn't sure if she would feel anxious or depressed, or if she'd forget to feel either of those things. She didn't even know she'd be able to feel anything. What she thought was that she probably wouldn't have any self-respect left by then to offend. But she did still believe that some part of her would continue to hurt from all the small indignities of an institutional life with nobody to love her. Engelhardt writes that skeptics of medical aid in dying argue that our focus should be on facilitating good lives, not curating good deaths. They say because there are no good deaths, or because the quality of our death is out of our hands, or because our quixotic preoccupation with engineering the perfect final hour is a disproportionate use of our efforts, which would be better spent improving life. But Deborah didn't feel that way. She felt her ending mattered. She was the one that would have to live it after all. Also, endings had a way of changing the way that a person's whole life was remembered, and Deborah didn't want a bad one. She thought with Fenn's help, she could script her life story all the way to her final breath. And that's what she did. Brian and his associates at Fenn reminded her that she needed to have a plan for the discovery of her body. You don't want somebody accidentally stumbling across a death scene that they're not expecting. The exit guides could sit with her. They could close the curtains before they left the house, but they couldn't be the ones to call the police. Not all her friends were on board with her decision, of course, so Deborah had to make them alone. She showed the author of this article the spot by the living room window where she planned to kill herself. It overlooked the beach and the tide. Brian had asked her what kind of music she wanted playing. She should think about that and her last meal. But all Deborah wanted was a photo of her husband beside her and for her last sight to be of the water. She was checking ahead to see when it would be a clear day, when the ongoing rain would stop. She said she started to talk to God for the first time in years, saying, "I need a really strong message. You know, I need to know either you put a light at the end of the tunnel that says it's not time for me to go, or you point me in the direction that says it is time." She said she would see all sorts of things as signs that God was trying to deliver messages to her. The broken boiler was a sign. Bottle of balsamic vinegar she dropped on the kitchen floor was a sign. The letters from the mortgage company were signs. The writer said that Deborah was dismissive of the hypotheticals she lobbed her way, whether she would stay if her husband was still alive, or if she had enough money to keep the home. Deborah said, "But I don't have enough money, and I don't have a lot of people who care about me or would care for me, and what you see in here isn't the real me." When Brian and the exit team arrived, Deborah was ready to go. He told her she still had time to change her mind, but Deborah said, "Let's do this." When the officers stepped inside her home afterwards, they found yellow post-it notes on everything, where they'd purchased the bed frame, a note on the dryer indicating its temperature range, notes on the antiques saying some of them were valuable and not to sell for nothing. After looking through the house for hours, the officers decided that nothing looked amiss, that Deborah had known what she was doing and had done it completely independently. The only thing that they thought was strange was that all the curtains were drawn, even though it was a beautiful day outside. Well, listener, that's the end of the story. You've been listening to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My show tonight was about life being a temporary thing, something most of us can't quite acknowledge. So let's focus on how we should live our lives. Steve Jobs' idea, and something that he adopted in the later part of his life, was to live each day as if it were your last. whereas author and speaker Liana Dell tried that and found it depressing. But she had a friend who also fell ill and didn't know how long her life was going to be, but she decided to live each day as if it were her first, and she found that much more inspiring. And then there was the story of Deborah Cousett, who was deteriorating fast and decided she would literally take her life into her own hands and bid it farewell on her own terms. And that's what she did when her life was coming to an end, something that is the option only in a few of the United States, but not all. Anyway, listen, it's all food for thought, which is what I try to provide on this, the Sharing Hour, on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX935. If you want to hear this show again, you can go to our website, where you can hear podcasts of all our shows and catch up on all the various events and offers we have going. I encourage you to do that. For this particular show, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. Meantime, this is Sharon James wishing you only the best out of life, whatever method you choose to live it by, and hoping that you'll come back and listen for more topics, conversations, interviews, and such every Monday night at 9 p.m.